This is the Cambridge Assessment International Education, Cambridge IGCSE, June 2022 examination in English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers. And when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you're all ready, here is the exam. Exercise 1. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. What did the man buy in the clothes shop? B. Who did the man buy it for?
I went to that new clothes shop in town yesterday.
Oh, I heard they've got some great stuff.
Yeah, although I went in thinking I'd buy a jumper, but nothing appealed. There was a scarf I liked, but it was expensive.
Right.
Then I spotted a shirt that was a real bargain, so I came home with that instead.
Don't you have loads of those already?
Well, I've got a cousin that absolutely hates shopping for clothes. It'll be perfect for him. I really wanted to find a present for a neighbour, but I couldn't see anything suitable. I've got a colleague who's always buying clothes, though. He'll love that shop. I went to that new clothes shop in town yesterday.
Oh, I heard they've got some great stuff.
Yeah, although I went in thinking I'd buy a jumper, but nothing appealed. There was a scarf I liked, but it was expensive.
Right.
Then I spotted a shirt that was a real bargain, so I came home with that instead.
Don't you have loads of those already?
Well, I've got a cousin that absolutely hates shopping for clothes. It'll be perfect for him. I really wanted to find a present for a neighbour, but I couldn't see anything suitable. I've got a colleague who's always buying clothes, though. He'll love that shop.
Question 2. A. Where did the woman go on holiday? B. How did the woman get there?
Hi, Lucy. I'm just back from holiday. As you know, I'd planned to go to the seaside again. Then, at the last minute, I started having doubts. I was looking in a travel agent's window, and among the holiday trips to some lakes, I noticed there was one to the mountains, and it felt like just what I needed. But instead of going by air this time, I decided to see a bit more along the way. I considered travelling by car, but my destination was miles away. Then I discovered you could go by ship from the local port, so I booked it. Anyway, speak soon. Hi, Lucy. I'm just back from holiday. As you know, I'd planned to go to the seaside again. Then, at the last minute, I started having doubts. I was looking in a travel agent's window, and among the holiday trips to some lakes, I noticed there was one to the mountains, and it felt like just what I needed. But instead of going by air this time, I decided to see a bit more along the way. I considered travelling by car, but my destination was miles away. Then I discovered you could go by ship from the local port, so I booked it. Anyway, speak soon.
Question 3. A. Where was the exhibition that the woman saw? B. What did the woman like most at the exhibition?
I went to an art exhibition the other day. I noticed it as I was heading into the city centre. It was being held at the library. I'd never been to an exhibition there before.
How was it?
Well, I didn't think the venue was great. The museum would have been better, or even the big gallery. Still, there was some great art there. I bought some postcards. Look.
That sculpture's amazing. It's huge.
And there was a portrait by a local artist that wasn't bad either. This vase really caught my attention, though. So beautiful.
Sounds as if I should go and see the exhibition.
I went to an art exhibition the other day. I noticed it as I was heading into the city centre. It was being held at the library. I'd never been to an exhibition there before.
How was it?
Well, I didn't think the venue was great. The museum would have been better, or even the big gallery. Still, there was some great art there. I bought some postcards. Look.
That sculpture's amazing. It's huge.
And there was a portrait by a local artist that wasn't bad either. This vase really caught my attention, though. So beautiful.
Sounds as if I should go and see the exhibition.
Question 4. A. What will the weather be like in the south tomorrow morning? B. What might be a problem in the south tomorrow evening?
Hello there. Here is the weather forecast for the southern region from 6 o'clock this evening. As we go through the night, the windy weather we've been having should calm down to be replaced by rainy weather from sunrise onwards tomorrow. There's very little prospect of sunny weather for the day ahead, I'm afraid. Then, as we head towards the evening, there's a chance of seeing some snow in places, unfortunately. And later on in the week, there may be some frost, as there will be some clear, cold nights. Hello there. Here is the weather forecast for the southern region from 6 o'clock this evening. As we go through the night, the windy weather we've been having should calm down to be replaced by rainy weather from sunrise onwards tomorrow. There's very little prospect of sunny weather for the day ahead, I'm afraid. Then, as we head towards the evening, there's a chance of seeing some snow in places, unfortunately. And later on in the week, there may be some frost, as there will be some clear, cold nights.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear exercise 2. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 2. You will hear a student called Janine giving a talk about taking up running as a hobby. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write one or two words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Hi, I'm Janine and I've recently taken up running as a hobby. I'd like to tell you about it and hopefully encourage you to do the same. I have to say, though, before my first run, I felt really nervous. So unlike lots of runners, I didn't head straight for the local sports centre, where there's a track to run around. Instead, I didn't go any further than a street close to where I live, so that I could run back if necessary. But I hoped I'd soon move on to running in the park nearby. The first time I went out running, I didn't think I'd be able to run continuously for very long. I was fully expecting to have to stop pretty quickly, but actually managed an incredible 3 minutes before I was out of breath, which was 2 minutes longer than I'd ever run before. I was pleased with that and felt encouraged to keep practicing until I could get up to 5 minutes. After that, I decided to use a running program I found online to help me. The program emphasised the importance of starting slowly so that you wouldn't get injured. I wasn't that interested in improving my speed. For me, it was about slowly increasing my strength, which the programme successfully taught me to do. But I was pleased to find that, even at the beginning, my fitness was better than I'd thought. Anyway, in less than a month, I'd changed my attitude to running. When I first started, I was monitoring my heartbeat really closely. But soon, I wasn't noticing that anymore. Instead, I concentrated on my footsteps, and I was beginning to feel very happy after each run. During my runs, I also learned that using headphones helped me. I know many people listen to music, and I've also tried that. But what might sound strange is that I actually found poetry much more effective. I also tried listening to the news, but that failed to have the same result. I also began appreciating things around me during my runs. I'd always looked at things like the clouds in the sky, because the weather's always important no matter what you're doing. Though now, I was beginning to notice the trees more than I'd ever done before. They were astonishing. As I started to feel better about my running, I began to get more ambitious with my routes around the town. I planned to run along a canal at one point, but then I discovered it was still being used for transporting goods, so it was quite busy. So I followed a railway that hadn't been used for years. That was very peaceful. Anyway, I found that it's very important to give myself a reward when I return home from a run. It's one of the most motivating things you can do. My favourite used to be cake, but I found ice cream is far more refreshing and something I really look forward to. It's much more effective after a run than chocolate, which I normally love eating. Does anyone have any questions?
Now you will hear the talk again.
Hi, I'm Janine and I've recently taken up running as a hobby. I'd like to tell you about it and hopefully encourage you to do the same. I have to say though, before my first run, I felt really nervous. So unlike lots of runners, I didn't head straight for the local sports centre where there's a track to run around. Instead, I didn't go any further than a street close to where I live so that I could run back if necessary. But I hoped I'd soon move on to running in the park nearby. The first time I went out running, I didn't think I'd be able to run continuously for very long. I was fully expecting to have to stop pretty quickly, but actually managed an incredible 3 minutes before I was out of breath, which was 2 minutes longer than I'd ever run before. I was pleased with that and felt encouraged to keep practicing until I could get up to 5 minutes. After that, I decided to use a running program I found online to help me. The program emphasized the importance of starting slowly so that you wouldn't get injured. I wasn't that interested in improving my speed. For me, it was about slowly increasing my strength, which the program successfully taught me to do. But I was pleased to find that, even at the beginning, my fitness was better than I'd thought. Anyway, in less than a month, I'd changed my attitude to running. When I first started, I was monitoring my heartbeat really closely, but soon I wasn't noticing that anymore. Instead, I concentrated on my footsteps, and I was beginning to feel very happy after each run. During my runs, I also learned that using headphones helped me. I know many people listen to music, and I've also tried that. But what might sound strange is that I actually found poetry much more effective. I also tried listening to the news, but that failed to have the same result. I also began appreciating things around me during my runs. I'd always looked at things like the clouds in the sky, because the weather's always important no matter what you're doing. Though now, I was beginning to notice the trees more than I'd ever done before. They were astonishing. As I started to feel better about my running, I began to get more ambitious with my routes around the town. I planned to run along a canal at one point, but then I discovered it was still being used for transporting goods, so it was quite busy. So I followed a railway that hadn't been used for years. That was very peaceful. Anyway, I found that it's very important to give myself a reward when I return home from a run. It's one of the most motivating things you can do. My favourite used to be cake, but I found ice cream is far more refreshing and something I really look forward to. It's much more effective after a run than chocolate, which I normally love eating. Does anyone have any questions?
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear exercise 3. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 3. You will hear 6 people talking about fashion and the way they dress. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
I love looking through fashion magazines, seeing how the celebrities are dressed, but I just use them for inspiration, as I then put together my own outfits from things that friends have given me as gifts. Once I'm happy with a combination, I tend to wear it for a long time, and I rarely meet anyone wearing the same outfit as me. But it's not the reason I do all this. It's simply that I can't afford to purchase lots of new clothes. A pity, really. I've got plenty of space in my wardrobe.
Speaker 2.
I'm interested in clothes and enjoy going shopping for them, but whether what I get is the latest stuff, I really couldn't say, because I don't spend too much time thinking about that. I just choose what suits me. And people do say I look okay. So although I like reading music magazines and watching pop stars performing, and would like to wear what they do, it just wouldn't work for me, I'm afraid. I have to dress fairly smartly for office meetings and so on, which limits my choices, really.
Speaker 3.
I take ages choosing clothes when shopping with friends, so I don't spend loads. It's not that I can't afford it, but I prefer making a few items go a long way. And I'm creative in how I wear them. So even though I've got only a few quality pieces, I enjoy using a scarf here or some jewellery there, so they look like completely new outfits. I quite like sticking to the same basic but fashionable pieces for a while. It saves me thinking about what to wear all the time.
Speaker 4.
I guess the things I wear are rather unusual. You'd notice me in a crowd. But that way, I don't risk running into anyone with the same sweater or whatever, which I really dislike. My mates are aware of how I feel, so they'd never turn up dressed in something identical to me. I don't buy that many new things, really. In fact, I've had some of the clothes I wear for a few years now. They were fashionable then and still look fine, but I think it's about time I updated them.
Speaker 5.
I like wearing up-to-date clothes and putting outfits together carefully, but if you asked me what my influences are, I couldn't tell you. It'd be nice to dress like famous musicians or film stars, but I couldn't afford that, and even if I could, I'd never spend that much on clothes. I guess I base my choice of clothes on what everyone around me wears, particularly people I'm close to. In fact, if we go shopping together, they'll often tell me what to buy.
Speaker 6.
The people I socialize with often tell me they've no idea how I'll be dressed each time they see me, which I think is a compliment. I'd hate to follow the same old trends day after day. That's not because I'm desperate to stand out from other people, and sometimes I do meet people wearing the same stuff as me, but that's fine. I do think some people suspect I've copied the latest celebrities, but I'm never that impressed with what I see them wearing, to be honest.
Now you will hear the 6 speakers again. Speaker 1.
I love looking through fashion magazines, seeing how the celebrities are dressed, but I just use them for inspiration, as I then put together my own outfits from things that friends have given me as gifts. Once I'm happy with a combination, I tend to wear it for a long time, and I rarely meet anyone wearing the same outfit as me. But it's not the reason I do all this. It's simply that I can't afford to purchase lots of new clothes. A pity, really. I've got plenty of space in my wardrobe.
Speaker 2.
I'm interested in clothes and enjoy going shopping for them, but whether what I get is the latest stuff, I really couldn't say because I don't spend too much time thinking about that. I just choose what suits me. And people do say I look okay. So although I like reading music magazines and watching pop stars performing and would like to wear what they do, it just wouldn't work for me, I'm afraid. I have to dress fairly smartly for office meetings and so on, which limits my choices, really.
Speaker 3.
I take ages choosing clothes when shopping with friends, so I don't spend loads. It's not that I can't afford it, but I prefer making a few items go a long way. And I'm creative in how I wear them. So even though I've got only a few quality pieces, I enjoy using a scarf here or some jewellery there, so they look like completely new outfits. I quite like sticking to the same basic but fashionable pieces for a while. It saves me thinking about what to wear all the time.
Speaker 4.
I guess the things I wear are rather unusual. You'd notice me in a crowd. But that way, I don't risk running into anyone with the same sweater or whatever, which I really dislike. My mates are aware of how I feel, so they'd never turn up dressed in something identical to me. I don't buy that many new things, really. In fact, I've had some of the clothes I wear for a few years now. They were fashionable then and still look fine, but I think it's about time I updated them.
Speaker 5.
I like wearing up-to-date clothes and putting outfits together carefully, but if you asked me what my influences are, I couldn't tell you. It'd be nice to dress like famous musicians or film stars, but I couldn't afford that, and even if I could, I'd never spend that much on clothes. I guess I base my choice of clothes on what everyone around me wears, particularly people I'm close to. In fact, if we go shopping together, they'll often tell me what to buy.
Speaker 6.
The people I socialize with often tell me they've no idea how I'll be dressed each time they see me, which I think is a compliment. I'd hate to follow the same old trends day after day. That's not because I'm desperate to stand out from other people, and sometimes I do meet people wearing the same stuff as me, but that's fine. I do think some people suspect I've copied the latest celebrities, but I'm never that impressed with what I see them wearing, to be honest.
That is the end of exercise 3. In a moment, you will hear exercise 4. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 4. You will hear an interview with a woman called Sophie Rudd, whose job is to find old black and white photos and add colour to them by hand. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
I'm with Sophie Rudd, whose job involves working with old black and white photos. She adds colour to these by hand using crayons and inks. Sophie, what first attracted you to colouring old photos?
I spotted some 100-year-old photos in a display at a local gallery. A contemporary photographer had added colour to them, and he was actually there, so we chatted about them. But their importance didn't really strike me until later, when I found a black and white photograph of my great-grandmother, which had been hand-coloured. It looked stunning, and I knew instantly that's what I wanted to do.
So why did hand-colouring photos originally become popular?
Well, it sounds a strange thing to do nowadays, when we can take great colour photos. But these weren't common when photography was first invented, because it was difficult and expensive to produce colour images. So a more affordable and attractive option was to add colour by hand to printed photos. And this continued well into the 1950s. But it wasn't very straightforward, so it's amazing there were so many good ones, and they're still around today.
And how were these hand-coloured photos used?
Well, sometimes on holiday postcards, believe it or not. Holiday makers sent them to their friends, who then kept them for years and put them in albums to look at again and again. The weird thing was, though, that the artists colouring the photos often hadn't been to these places, so it was the artist who decided what they looked like. And recently, I actually saw some hand-coloured photos on the covers of a few popular books.
But how did you learn to hand-colour photos?
Well, it's amazing what you can do when you're determined. I started by looking for a teacher, but didn't come across anyone, although I've since found plenty of skilled people online. But I did find some useful online tutorial films, and that way I learned the basics. And when my mother, who's a historian, saw what I was doing, she found me a few examples of hand-coloured photos from decades ago.
And is that how you developed your approach to working with historical photos?
Probably. And research is the most important part of that, with very old pictures. Before I start selecting which colours to add to the photos, I'll look carefully at what's in them. If it's something like an old building, I'll work with qualified historians and collect information about it, although that might not be necessary every time if what's in the photo is well known.
So what do you do once you've begun working on a photo?
Well, occasionally, as I'm working, I have to pause and think before I go any further. And there are some photos that I start working on, then find they don't work in colour. They just don't look right. Then, unfortunately, I have to abandon them, so that's time wasted. But that's part of the creative process. On the other hand, sometimes the best ones actually end up looking more like paintings in a strange way.
And now you've produced a book of historical photos.
Yes. I began putting my photos onto social media and soon found people were following what I was doing. Then a well-known historian saw them and got in touch. We've worked together a lot since then. That's how the book of photos got published. But the nicest comments were when teachers said the book got young students much more interested in history, as having colour in the photos really helped them to see what was in the photos as much more relevant to their lives now.
So what are your plans for the future?
Well, ideally, I'd like to share my experiences, but I know that I'm not very good at teaching in a classroom setting. So I'm looking into organising presentations to local groups about my fascination with old photos. I'd like to show them the coloured versions and what results can be achieved. Who knows? They might be inspired to learn to do it themselves by taking a course or something.
Sophie, thanks.
Now you will hear the interview again.
I'm with Sophie Rudd, whose job involves working with old black and white photos. She adds colour to these by hand using crayons and inks. Sophie, what first attracted you to colouring old photos?
I spotted some 100-year-old photos in a display at a local gallery. A contemporary photographer had added colour to them, and he was actually there, so we chatted about them. But their importance didn't really strike me until later, when I found a black and white photograph of my great-grandmother, which had been hand-coloured. It looked stunning, and I knew instantly that's what I wanted to do.
So why did hand-colouring photos originally become popular?
Well, it sounds a strange thing to do nowadays, when we can take great colour photos. But these weren't common when photography was first invented, because it was difficult and expensive to produce colour images. So a more affordable and attractive option was to add colour by hand to printed photos. And this continued well into the 1950s. But it wasn't very straightforward, so it's amazing there were so many good ones, and they're still around today.
And how were these hand-coloured photos used?
Well, sometimes on holiday postcards, believe it or not. Holidaymakers sent them to their friends, who then kept them for years and put them in albums to look at again and again. The weird thing was, though, that the artists colouring the photos often hadn't been to these places, so it was the artist who decided what they looked like. And recently, I actually saw some hand-coloured photos on the covers of a few popular books.
But how did you learn to hand-colour photos?
Well, it's amazing what you can do when you're determined. I started by looking for a teacher, but didn't come across anyone, although I've since found plenty of skilled people online. But I did find some useful online tutorial films, and that way I learned the basics. And when my mother, who's a historian, saw what I was doing, she found me a few examples of hand-coloured photos from decades ago.
And is that how you developed your approach to working with historical photos?
Probably. And research is the most important part of that, with very old pictures. Before I start selecting which colours to add to the photos, I'll look carefully at what's in them. If it's something like an old building, I'll work with qualified historians and collect information about it, although that might not be necessary every time if what's in the photo is well known.
So what do you do once you've begun working on a photo?
Well, occasionally, as I'm working, I have to pause and think before I go any further. And there are some photos that I start working on, then find they don't work in colour, they just don't look right. Then, unfortunately, I have to abandon them, so that's time wasted. But that's part of the creative process. On the other hand, sometimes the best ones actually end up looking more like paintings in a strange way.
And now you've produced a book of historical photos.
Yes. I began putting my photos onto social media and soon found people were following what I was doing. Then a well-known historian saw them and got in touch. We've worked together a lot since then. That's how the book of photos got published. But the nicest comments were when teachers said the book got young students much more interested in history, as having colour in the photos really helped them to see what was in the photos as much more relevant to their lives now.
So what are your plans for the future?
Well, ideally, I'd like to share my experiences, but I know that I'm not very good at teaching in a classroom setting. So I'm looking into organising presentations to local groups about my fascination with old photos. I'd like to show them the coloured versions and what results can be achieved. Who knows? They might be inspired to learn to do it themselves by taking a course or something.
Sophie, thanks.
That is the end of the interview. In a moment, you will hear exercise 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Exercise 5, Part A. You will hear wildlife journalist James Wright giving a talk about animals called beavers. These animals build wooden structures called dams across rivers. Listen to the talk and complete the notes in Part A. Write one or two words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
I'm James Wright, a wildlife journalist, and I've been following a study in my local area in England involving creatures called beavers, large furry mammals that live along rivers. The study's main aim has been to find out whether beavers could be safely brought back to areas where they died out back in the 1600s. The study, local to me, focused on wild beavers that are believed to have escaped from a nearby wildlife park in 2013. It was later that same year that authorities came across the animals, which were living alongside a river. In 2015, there were 2 breeding pairs there, which grew to 8 pairs in 2020, as the animals expanded their habitat. Probably the thing that everyone knows about beavers is that they build dams, or fences, across rivers using sticks and mud. These structures give beaver families some security by protecting them from foxes, and they also create areas of deep water where they can construct their homes and float their food along the water. During the study, there were initial concerns this activity could cause problems. However, these dams have actually brought great advantages to areas near the river. One such bonus is that they've reduced how quickly floodwater flows through villages close by and have made it less likely that these places will be affected during sudden storms, for example. Another benefit is that the dams seem to clean up the river water as it passes through them, so they stop any rubbish in the river, such as paper and plastic, from going any further. They also absorb some chemicals, which may have entered the water from nearby agricultural fields. This results in better water quality. Admittedly, during the study, there have also been one or two incidents of beavers eating things they weren't meant to. For example, not long ago, some garden plants were found to have been partly consumed, and it was initially feared that nearby orchards of fruit trees were also at risk, as beavers tend to chew at the trunks. However, beaver-proof wire fences prevented this. The overall feeling is that the beavers have had a more positive than negative impact. So local people have been prepared to help the beavers and actively manage any problems, and that's good news for people like me who take such an interest in these amazing animals.
Now you will hear the talk again.
I'm James Wright, a wildlife journalist, and I've been following a study in my local area in England involving creatures called beavers, large furry mammals that live along rivers. The study's main aim has been to find out whether beavers could be safely brought back to areas where they died out back in the 1600s. The study, local to me, focused on wild beavers that are believed to have escaped from a nearby wildlife park in 2013. It was later that same year that authorities came across the animals, which were living alongside a river. In 2015, there were two breeding pairs there, which grew to 8 pairs in 2020, as the animals expanded their habitat. Probably the thing that everyone knows about beavers is that they build dams, or fences, across rivers using sticks and mud. These structures give beaver families some security by protecting them from foxes, and they also create areas of deep water where they can construct their homes and float their food along the water. During the study, there were initial concerns this activity could cause problems. However, these dams have actually brought great advantages to areas near the river. One such bonus is that they've reduced how quickly floodwater flows through villages close by and have made it less likely that these places will be affected during sudden storms, for example. Another benefit is that the dams seem to clean up the river water as it passes through them, so they stop any rubbish in the river, such as paper and plastic, from going any further. They also absorb some chemicals, which may have entered the water from nearby agricultural fields. This results in better water quality. Admittedly, during the study, there have also been one or two incidents of beavers eating things they weren't meant to. For example, not long ago, some garden plants were found to have been partly consumed, and it was initially feared that nearby orchards of fruit trees were also at risk, as beavers tend to chew at the trunks. However, beaver-proof wire fences prevented this. The overall feeling is that the beavers have had a more positive than negative impact. So local people have been prepared to help the beavers and actively manage any problems, and that's good news for people like me who take such an interest in these amazing animals.
Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two biology students about a study trip they're going on to learn more about beavers, and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
That was a really interesting talk about beavers, wasn't it? I must admit, they're not the kind of creatures I'd immediately identify with living in England. You tend to see them in films that are set in North America, don't you? Anyway, at least for this study trip, we don't have to travel too far to see them. Scotland is relatively close, and I can't wait to go.
I know. I was sort of hoping to go to Canada instead, really.
But it would have been quite an expensive trip.
You're right. And a long journey. So, how did you first get interested in studying these creatures?
Well, as a child, I spent loads of time observing frogs living near the river. Then at school, I did a project about the same habitat, but focusing on the resident birds. And while I was researching them, I happened to find out about beavers. My fascination started then, really.
Sounds interesting. Oh, I've also heard that beavers are what's called keystone species in certain ecosystems because they create areas of wetlands which are hugely beneficial to other wildlife. In fact, one author I've read claims that next to humans, no other wild creature appears to do more to change the landscape near these areas than the beaver. That's amazing, isn't it? And something I hadn't thought about before.
Well, I'm sure that's true. And from what I've read and learned, I'd say that beavers are going to make even greater contributions in the future. To agriculture, say.
Really? Is there any evidence for that?
Well, they certainly could be very important in helping to reduce the consequences of climate change, which is incredible.
They've definitely got the potential to do that.
No doubt about it.
Anyway, I'm keen to learn more. I know there's a presentation next week by a leading expert, but I'm not sure I can go.
Well, I found a great documentary, so maybe we can watch that together.
Right, OK. Then we can follow it up by reading that research paper you came across, if you want.
Well, let's see what time I've got available.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
That was a really interesting talk about beavers, wasn't it? I must admit, they're not the kind of creatures I'd immediately identify with living in England. You tend to see them in films that are set in North America, don't you? Anyway, at least for this study trip, we don't have to travel too far to see them. Scotland is relatively close, and I can't wait to go.
I know. I was sort of hoping to go to Canada instead, really. But it would have been quite an expensive trip.
You're right. And a long journey. So, how did you first get interested in studying these creatures?
Well, as a child, I spent loads of time observing frogs living near the river. Then at school, I did a project about the same habitat, but focusing on the resident birds. And while I was researching them, I happened to find out about beavers. My fascination started then, really.
Sounds interesting. Oh, I've also heard that beavers are what's called keystone species in certain ecosystems because they create areas of wetlands which are hugely beneficial to other wildlife. In fact, one author I've read claims that next to humans, no other wild creature appears to do more to change the landscape near these areas than the beaver. That's amazing, isn't it? And something I hadn't thought about before.
Well, I'm sure that's true. And from what I've read and learned, I'd say that beavers are going to make even greater contributions in the future. To agriculture, say.
Really? Is there any evidence for that?
Well, they certainly could be very important in helping to reduce the consequences of climate change, which is incredible.
They've definitely got the potential to do that.
No doubt about it.
Anyway, I'm keen to learn more. I know there's a presentation next week by a leading expert, but I'm not sure I can go.
Well, I found a great documentary, so maybe we can watch that together.
Right, OK. Then we can follow it up by reading that research paper you came across, if you want.
Well, let's see what time I've got available.
That is the end of exercise 5 and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.